welcome to Lecture 6, Space Telescopes and the Celestial Sphere. As we saw last time, telescopes play a crucial role in astronomy. We use them to collect the light, bring it to a focus, and then analyze the light. But telescopes on the ground have a number of disadvantages. The first, as we have seen already, and is shown again in this image, is that the stars are blurred by the Earth's atmosphere. And although there are techniques that are beginning to overcome that, such as adaptive optics and interferometry, there are limitations to those techniques, and it will probably be a while before we get wide-angle images of the sky that are perfectly crisp and clear from the ground. So the blurring is a problem. Another problem is that the sky is bright at night, especially near cities such as San Jose, as seen here from Lick Observatory. Now, we can get far away from cities, and that helps us to some degree, but the sky also glows naturally at night. It's not perfectly black out there. There are molecules and things jumping around from one energy level to another, and they're emitting light. And this is especially the case at infrared wavelengths. At infrared wavelengths, our atmosphere glows to quite a considerable degree. And at some infrared wavelengths, the sky is just as bright at night as it is during the day. So we can't get away from the brightness of the night sky down here from Earth. The third is that, as we've seen, electromagnetic radiation consists not just of visible light, but also at wavelengths shorter than violet, such as ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays, and wavelengths longer than red, like the infrared and radio. Visible light and radio waves are transmitted by the Earth's atmosphere, and some infrared waves are as well. But ultraviolet photons are blocked. They're blocked by ozone in the Earth's atmosphere at altitudes of 20 to 40 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And infrared is blocked by water vapor, roughly 2 to 10 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And X-rays and gamma rays are blocked by a variety of molecules in the Earth's atmosphere. So really, the only thing that comes through well is visible light and radio waves, and a little bit of the infrared. So we would like to study the entire electromagnetic spectrum, and we can't do that from the ground simply because the light is blocked. We can overcome some of these difficulties by going to high mountain sites, such as this one, Mauna Kea volcano in Hawaii. I mentioned it last time because I said that the twin Keck telescopes run by Caltech and the University of California, with some support from NASA and Hawaii, they're up there. You can see them here in this image, right there and there. And there are about a dozen other telescopes way up there on this high, forlorn peak. It's way far away from major city lights, so it's a pretty dark sky, though we can't get away from the natural sky glow. And it's pretty high up as well, so we get above some, but not all, of the water vapor that messes up infrared wavelengths, for example. So that's a good site, but it doesn't overcome all of the difficulties. There's even a little bit of blurring there, because though we're above much of the atmosphere, we're not above the remaining parts, and they still cause the stars to blur. We can put some telescopes in airplanes. This is an artist's conception of what an infrared telescope to be completed in the next few years will look like. It will fly in an airplane, and there will be a little window in the airplane through which the telescope looks. This is based on a previous design that was very successful. It was called the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, and it has provided lots of good infrared views of the heavens. This telescope, SOFIA, will be even better. In general, it's cheap to keep telescopes on the ground and to fly them in airplanes. It's expensive to send telescopes way up in space in permanent Earth orbits, things like that. So when possible, we should do projects with ground-based telescopes or with telescopes flown in airplanes, because per bit of information, the observations are cheaper, and astronomy has limited funding. But there are some observations that can only be done with space telescopes, so we need to launch them. This is an example of an infrared telescope, IRAS, that was flown in the early 1980s. and it produced some stunning information about the sky at infrared wavelengths that are simply not visible from the ground because our sky is so bright due to the glowing Earth's atmosphere. IRAS did a very good job. And there was an ultraviolet telescope called the International Ultraviolet Explorer that provide data at UV wavelengths for nearly 20 years before it was decommissioned a couple of years ago. So we've done pretty well in terms of space telescopes, and we've used them wisely and fairly cheaply. But what we really wanted to do is have a permanent space telescope with a large mirror orbiting the Earth, providing nice images. Most of these other telescopes didn't provide nice images. And the Hubble Space Telescope was designed for that purpose and was launched with the space shuttle in April of 1990. It had a 2.4-meter diameter mirror. It would provide nice images because it had a whole set of CCDs built inside. And it would really improve the clarity with which we could view the universe by roughly a factor of 10 over what had been achievable prior to that time. Suppose you have 2200 vision. It's as though you suddenly put on a pair of glasses or contact lenses that improved your vision to 20/20. That's the kind of improvement in clarity at optical wavelengths that we expected with the Hubble Space Telescope, the first real large telescope to have good imaging devices within it. Well, here's an artist's view of what the Hubble Space Telescope would look like viewing a galaxy far away. Above the Earth's atmosphere, it would not only have a clear view of that galaxy, but it could also observe at ultraviolet wavelengths and infrared wavelengths. It's really not designed to view the universe at gamma rays or X-rays or radio wavelengths. We expected these very clear images, but here's what we got. This is what we got. Most of the light is spread out in a very awful-looking pattern like this. Only a small percentage of the light is focused sharply in the center, as it should have been if the space telescope had been properly manufactured. Most of the light should have been in the center. Well, this was kind of a disaster. What went wrong? The mirror of the telescope, shown here, has slightly the wrong shape globally. It is a nice, perfectly smooth surface. If you measured the irregularities on it and expanded the mirror to the size of the United States, they would be only about 6 inches high. If you did the same thing to your glasses, the irregularities would be the size of skyscrapers. So the smoothness was not a problem, but the global shape was a problem. It suffered from spherical aberration. The mirror was a little bit too much like the shape of the surface of a sphere. It wasn't exactly the right shape. And this was a problem that had been partly noticed, I guess, when the mirror was still on the ground, but two tests had been done. One indicated that something was wrong, the other indicated that everything was okay, and the people on the ground decided to trust the test that said that everything was okay. That was, I think, a case of being penny wise and pound foolish. It would not have been too difficult or expensive to make a third test prior to launch, or better yet, to figure out what was wrong with the telescope. So there were enormous headlines after this. Newsweek ran a headline. It said, "Star crossed, NASA's $1.5 billion blunder." Another story said, "Heaven can wait." You know, there were all sorts of cartoons, pictures of God saying, "No pictures, please," you know. So it was not good public relations for science or for astronomy. Admittedly, the mistake should not have been made. But was all hope lost? Not really. Here is a picture of a star cluster taken from the ground. Now, don't worry too much about the square shape of the stars. That's just an artifact of the pixels on the CCD that was used to take the picture. What you should look at is that there's a bunch of stars, and they're spaced quite closely together, and it's hard to tell one star apart from the other. Now here, in the next image, is the same cluster imaged with the Hubble Space Telescope, even in its aberrated form. However, what was done to this image was some computer processing. Since, after the fact, we knew exactly what the problem was, we could correct the light that was detected and make it look like the images were sharp. This technique works quite well as long as the stars are sufficiently bright to have registered enough light in that small, sharp core that only had a minor fraction of the total light. If your star was too faint to have registered enough light in that core, then this reconstruction didn't work very well. But if your star was bright enough to register enough light in the sharp core, you could run these computer reconstruction techniques and gain back what you lost. So what happened was that for the first couple of years of the Hubble Space Telescope, the projects that were meant to be done with the telescope over its 10 or 15 year lifetime were simply reprioritized. Those that were least affected by the spherical aberration were done first, saving the harder projects for later on when the telescope got fixed. So we actually used the telescope wisely during the time when it was still in its aberrated form. Nevertheless, we want it to be fixed once and for all, and here in this slide, you can see a picture of the astronauts during the December 1993 servicing mission, where they effectively placed corrective optics into the telescope. In one case, they completely replaced one of the cameras of the telescope. In several of the other instruments, they essentially put the equivalent of contact lenses, but in this case, it's all done with mirrors because you don't want chromatic aberration. So they put these little corrective optics into the telescope to produce a sharp focus. And they were absolute heroes. Not only did they do that, but they fixed some other broken things, and they replaced the solar panels that were about to break off, and they did a lot of stuff. But in this slide, you can see a before and after comparison of the central part of a galaxy, before correction for the optics or for the spherical aberration, and afterwards. You can see the great difference in the clarity of the image. Some other examples are this famous picture, the Hubble Deep Field, where you can see in this small, tiny part of the sky, 1/100 millionth of the total sky, you can actually see 1,000 galaxies. Almost all of these little dots are galaxies, like our Milky Way. Only one or two of the dots is a star in our own galaxy. A picture like this couldn't have been obtained from the ground. This is the kind of clarity that can only be achieved with a telescope in space, at least based on the kind of technology that we have right now and for the foreseeable future, perhaps the next 10 or 20 years. Here is a picture of a dying star. We'll study these later. It's a sun-like star that's burping out its outer atmosphere of gas in its dying stages. It's sort of erupting in a gentle way, spewing this stuff out. And we can now study the details of this process with the refurbished Hubble Space Telescope. And here, another famous picture is of the Eagle Nebula. It is a bunch of gas and dust, which is so dense that you can't see through it. That's why it appears dark. And it is in these densest parts that gas and dust are gravitationally contracting, right as we speak, to form new stars. So new stars are being formed inside those pillars. And we can actually see those stars in the process of formation by using infrared and radio wavelengths, which are more easily able to pass through gas and dust. I'll talk about that later. So the pictures from Hubble have been stunning. And the spectroscopy that Hubble has done has also been stunning, but you can't so easily visually portray it, so I don't show it. So after pictures like this were published, the new headlines, rather than saying, "Heaven can wait," they said something like this: "Heaven photographed by Hubble telescope." Well, wait a minute. Okay, I'm not going to go into religion here. You can believe it or you cannot believe it. But I don't think that any of the NASA astronomers who have data claim that they have actually seen where heaven is. So don't believe absolutely everything you read in various reputable or not so reputable journals. "We found where God lives," says scientist, who was later fired probably. Anyway, it's a smashing success, and much of the work that I'll be discussing in these 40 lectures will have stemmed from the Hubble Space Telescope, in that I'm going to be emphasizing contemporary, modern astronomy in these lectures, and certainly the space telescope has provided data that have really revolutionized some of our views of the cosmos. All right, well, NASA is now working on plans for an 8-meter diameter space telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope is only 2.4 meters in diameter. NASA wants to build an 8-meter diameter space telescope with which we can search for planets and look at the birth of galaxies and things like that. That'll probably be built in about a decade. The shuttle crew that did this fix is just a bunch of heroes. These seven men and women did a tremendous job, and we as astronomers owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to them. Well, I'd like to now move on to the celestial sphere, to the view of the night sky, the stars, their motions. What do we perceive here from the surface of the Earth? And when we look at the night sky, the thing that we most obviously see are stars, these bright points of light that have for such a long time mystified people. Of course, we now know that they are distant suns like our own. But for a long time, they were just mysterious little points of light. And the ancients grouped these into patterns. Here we see Leo the lion. Here's Leo's tail, the body, and then the sickle of Leo is the head. That actually even kind of looks like a lion. Scorpius, the scorpion, looks like a scorpion. Orion, the hunter, looks kind of like a person, like a hunter. Most of the constellations don't look like what they're named after. They were largely named in honor of the beasts or people or gods that bear their names. They don't really look like these objects. But people wanted to form patterns in the sky, and they wanted to see how these patterns rise and fall as the seasons progressed, so they could know when to plant their crops and when the Nile was going to flood and things like that. So it was useful for people to make these patterns. There are 88 of these so-called constellations recognized in modern times. Every star belongs to one and only one constellation. Most of them are now named in honor of Greek heroes, although Egyptian culture and Mexican culture, South American culture all had their own stories to go along with these things. Most of the surviving ones, at least in the Western world, are named after Greek heroes. Some of the ones in the Southern Hemisphere have names like Microscopium and Telescopium and things like that, because the ancient Greeks did not know about the far southern skies and did not see those constellations and hadn't named them yet. There are also things called asterisms. The Big Dipper here, here's the bowl of the dipper, and there's the handle. That is part of a much bigger grouping of stars called Ursa Major, the Great Bear. How you get a bear out of this is a little bit beyond me. But the Big Dipper, part of a constellation, is called an asterism. It's a familiar grouping of stars, which is not in and of itself an entire constellation. So there are asterisms and there are constellations. Now, you might think that the stars in a given constellation, being relatively close to each other, are somehow associated with one another, or at the same distance, or formed together, or are bound together, or something like that. And that, in fact, in general, turns out not to be the case. The apparent patterns of the constellations are simply accidental patterns that occur because stars at different distances happen to line up with one another. Most of the stars in most constellations have no physical relationship to each other. It's as though you're looking through a crowd of people, and you see nearby people lined up with distant people, but though they appear close in angular distance from each other, they have no physical relationship with each other. The Big Dipper actually is a little bit of a counterexample to that. You can see here that five of the seven stars are about at the same distance, not quite at the same distance, between 60 and 90 light years away. They're clearly not physically bound, being separated by tens of light years, but they're at least reasonably close together, and they did form together from the same nebula, from the same cloud of gas and dust. And to first approximation, they're moving into the same direction of the heavens with each other. But the other two stars are clearly quite a bit more distant, and in fact are moving in an opposite direction. So even the Big Dipper consists of stars at different distances and physically unrelated to each other, although five of the seven stars in the Big Dipper are, in fact, physically related to each other. So that's a bit of a counterexample. But here in this slide, you can actually see the motion of the seven stars in the Big Dipper. Five of them are moving roughly to the left, as seen in this diagram, and the end star of the handle, as well as the tip of the bowl, are moving in roughly the opposite direction, very slowly through the sky. So in fact, if you were to have looked at the Big Dipper 50,000 years ago, this is what it would have appeared like. Its handle wouldn't have been quite as bent at the end, and the bowl wouldn't have been quite as well formed because the tip star of the bowl would have been squashed toward the other three a little bit more. Now, 50,000 years from today, the Big Dipper's shape will have changed again. It changes continuously, of course, but the handle will be more bent and the bowl will be lengthened a little bit because these two stars at the ends are moving in different directions than the other stars. So the constellations change in shape slowly over tens of thousands of years. All right, well now let's consider the entire celestial sphere, not just constellations within them. Let's define two quantities. The zenith is just the point in the sky directly over you. All right, you look straight up, that's the zenith. And the horizon is 90 degrees, one quarter of a circle, down from the zenith, in whatever direction you choose to look. Now, there might be mountains in the way, or trees or buildings. Those produce a false horizon. Those are not your true horizon. And you know that when the sun sets behind a house, the sky doesn't suddenly become dark. It has to set below the true horizon. The true horizon is what you get when you look along the surface of the Earth. If you were to look farther down, you would be looking through the surface of the Earth, which you can't do. So that's your horizon. And so if we look at the celestial sphere here, it's as though the stars were plastered on a sphere very, very far away from us. To a first approximation, we can't tell how far the way the stars are, at least not with our naked eye. And so it kind of looks like they're just plastered on a sphere very, very far away, and that sphere rotates around us. That's what we call the celestial sphere. Your zenith is just the point directly over you, okay, on the celestial sphere. Your horizon is the plane, or in this case, the great circle in the sky, which is the intersection of the plane tangent to where you're standing and the celestial sphere. That's your horizon. A projection of Earth's equator onto the celestial sphere produces what's called the celestial equator. It's just a great circle, which is a circle produced by a plane passing through the center of a sphere. Airplanes travel largely on great circles to minimize the distances, for example. And so that's the celestial equator. And the celestial poles are simply the extensions of the north and south poles. Okay, so there's the south celestial pole, and here's the north celestial pole. And the whole thing kind of rotates around these poles because the Earth is spinning along or around its axis. There's one other curve that I'd like to define, which isn't shown here, and that's the meridian. The meridian is the curve or great circle passing through your zenith, due south, and due north. So it's in a sense the highest point in the sky to which any star appears to rise. When the star is due south, it is crossing the meridian. All right? So it's the great circle going from north to south through the zenith. Okay, well, let's consider what we would see if we looked at the stars. We can assign each star a coordinate, much like we assign a coordinate to every point on the surface of the Earth. The latitude of a city is just the number of degrees or the fraction of a circle above for north or below for south Earth's equator. And the longitude is the number of degrees away from some arbitrary point. In this case on Earth, it's the prime meridian. It's the circle or the great circle passing through Greenwich, England. That's just the arbitrary point from which we measure longitude. On the sky, we have the declination, which is the corresponding coordinate of latitude, and the right ascension, which is the corresponding coordinate of longitude. And the zero point for right ascension happens to be the vernal equinox, the place in the sky where the sun is the first day of spring. All right? So we can define coordinates in the sky for every star that we observe. Well, why is it that we see only half of the celestial sphere at any given moment from any given position? If you place yourself here on Earth, then your horizon is effectively defined by the tangent to the Earth. You can't look through the Earth. You can only see at things that are above the Earth, so that defines your horizon. If the celestial sphere were close to the Earth, then the only parts of the celestial sphere that we could see would be this part above the horizon, and that would clearly be less than half of the full celestial sphere. If the celestial sphere were farther away, then the arc that we can see is clearly a bigger fraction of the total than was the case when the celestial sphere was small. If the celestial sphere is very far away, then you can see that the arc is nearly one half of the full circle. And if the celestial sphere is effectively infinitely far away, and compared to the size of the Earth, the stars are infinitely far away, you can see that what we can examine at any given time from any given point on Earth with a clear horizon is half of the celestial sphere. Okay? All right. Well, let's place ourselves on the North Pole of the Earth. What would we see? I claim that we would see the stars circling around the North Celestial Pole, never changing their altitude above the horizon. Different stars would have different altitudes above the horizon, and stars right on the celestial equator would be right on your horizon, because that would define the limit of the celestial sphere that you see. It's as though you're this little girl standing on the pole of the world, and the world is turning out underneath you, like that, but your feet are planted on Earth, so they go around with it. And you see first this direction, then that direction, then that direction, and so on. But you never see the stars in the southern hemisphere, the stars that are below the celestial equator, because your orientation relative to the celestial equator never changes. If, on the other hand, we're standing on the equator, which is shown here, then the axis of the Earth is perpendicular to our location or our direction from the center of the Earth. And it's as though the Earth rotates out from underneath us, but the opposite way. The celestial poles are on the horizon. Stars appear to rise straight up, go through graceful arcs, and set down in the west. All right? They rise in the east, set in the west. And all stars would do that. They would just kind of rise straight up, go over, and set straight down, like this. And you can see that throughout the course of a 24-hour day, your line of sight would intersect the entire celestial sphere. Let's go back to my girl here, who suppose now is on the equator. Okay, let's make this the poles now. I don't want to change her location. The Earth is spinning, and you can see that her perspective changes. She's seeing me now. Now she's seeing you over there. Now she's seeing you, and then finally you, and so on. Then back to me. So she can see the entire celestial sphere over the course of 24 hours. Now, only 12 of those hours will be dark, but in principle, the entire celestial sphere is visible. Whereas from the poles, even in principle, only half of the celestial sphere is visible, because you never sort of rotate out from under the Earth like this. Well, at intermediate locations, you can see that you'll have a combination of those two motions. Some of the stars will be above the horizon, some stars will be below the horizon, and most stars will rise sort of at an angle, cross the sky, and set at an angle. And this is illustrated with a photograph here showing the stars rising at an angle from the horizon, going up, and then they complete a loop around and set at an angle relative to the horizon. So they go neither in perfect circles at a constant altitude above the Earth's surface, nor do they rise straight up and set straight down. They sort of do something intermediate. You'll notice that some of the stars are above the horizon at all times. Those are called circumpolar stars. Again, it might not be dark at all times, but they will be above the horizon at all times. All right? Whereas other stars go below the horizon and are not even in principle seen at all times. But the pole star is above the horizon all the time. All right? And the stars near the pole are above the horizon. And here you can see, in fact, a picture of the Earth's north celestial pole. The star Polaris is near it. And all of these stars near Polaris are above Earth's horizon, as viewed from the latitude of all cities in the United States, all the time. And the closer you are to the pole, the greater is the fraction of the celestial sphere that is always above the horizon. The downside is, the smaller is the fraction of the total celestial sphere that you can see, even in principle. So on the equator, there are no circumpolar stars. The poles are right on the horizon. But you can see the whole celestial sphere. At the poles, all stars are circumpolar, but you can only see half of the celestial sphere. And by the way, our pole star, Polaris, happens to be a fairly bright star. It won't always be there because our axis of rotation is actually very slowly changing orientation every 26,000 years. And that's because the gravitational tugs of the sun and the moon cause it to wobble a little bit. But for all intents and purposes, over our lifetime, Polaris will be the pole star. In the southern hemisphere, shown here, there is no bright star near the pole. They're just unlucky right now. We will be unlucky later on when our Polaris star moves away. Okay, well, now let's look at how the night sky changes over the course of a year. How does our view of the night sky change with the seasons? Here's the sun in the middle, and here's the Earth. And in December, at midnight, the constellation Orion is visible nearly overhead. If you're on the equator, it's actually right overhead. So you can tell this is midnight here on Earth because we're halfway between sunset and sunrise. You're on the sort of the point on Earth which is most shaded from the sun. So that's midnight, looking this way. Now, in March, 3 months later, the Earth's orientation is like this compared with the sun. It has rotated over by 90 degrees. And now at midnight, you view a different set of stars. They happen to be the stars of Virgo. The direction of Orion, this direction in the sky, the direction toward Orion. Remember, Orion is very far away and all the light rays are coming in parallel. So the direction of Orion is seen at sunset. This is the sunset point on Earth. It's the point going from the sunlit part to the dark part. So at sunset, looking right at the horizon, you would see Orion. Well, if you're seeing Orion at sunset in March and at midnight in December, that means that over the course of 3 months, 90 days, the stars will have appeared to have shifted effectively by 6 hours. The difference in time between sunset and midnight is 6 hours. Sunset's around 6 p.m., midnight's around midnight, 12. So in the course of 90 days, our view of the sky has shifted by 6 hours. We are seeing Orion 6 hours earlier than we did in December. In March, we see it 6 hours earlier. Well, 90 days times 4 minutes per day is 360 minutes. That's 6 hours. Clearly, this is a continuous process. So with each day, the stars reach the overhead point, or rise, or set, doesn't matter which of these things you take, 4 minutes earlier. Each day that you look at the sky, a given star will rise 4 minutes earlier. So that over the course of 90 days, those 4 minutes per day times 90 days will be 360 minutes, 6 hours. That will make Orion be visible on the horizon at sunset in March versus overhead at midnight in December. Microscopically, here's what's happening. Suppose I am the Earth, I'm standing on the Earth, and the podium is the Sun, and you are a star over there. Well, I'm lining up the Sun and you right now, and I can't see you during the day, but forget about that. Let's forget about the Sun for a moment. All right, forget about the fact that it's bright. So I see you at noon directly overhead. Now, in one day, what will happen? I will rotate once like this, and I will see you in the camera when I'm pointing back at you. But the Sun will not yet be overhead, right? I have to rotate a little bit more over like this, an extra bit to see the Sun, because I will have moved roughly 1 degree along my orbit in that one day. The Earth moves 360 degrees, a full circuit around the Sun in 365 days. So it moves about 1 degree per day. So in that one day, I will have moved over. And so when a star, when a given star is overhead once again after one day, the Sun will not yet be overhead. I actually have to rotate for another 4 minutes, 3 minutes and 56 seconds to be precise, but 4 minutes among friends. And that is what leads to the rising of the stars 4 minutes earlier each day, because our clocks are set by solar time, not sidereal time, the time of the stars. Well, now let us consider the seasons. The seasons are caused not by differing distances of the Earth from the Sun, which is one of the common misconceptions, nor by some sort of a crazy flip that the Earth does on its axis, you know, sort of flopping back and forth, which is another popular misconception. But rather, it's due to the fact that Earth's orientation of its axis is tilted by 23.5 degrees relative to the perpendicular to the orbital plane. That axis tilt means that at some times of the year, the northern hemisphere is sort of pointed towards the Sun. Yes, it's a little bit closer to the Sun than the southern hemisphere, but that's not the point here. The distance is not the point. It's that it's angled toward the Sun, all right? And the southern hemisphere is angled away from the Sun. And in fact, the South Pole gets hidden from the Sun entirely, and the North Pole is always in the Sun's light. And 6 months later, when the Earth has gone to this position relative to the Sun, its axis of rotation will have remained fixed. It doesn't flip-flop physically in space, but rather, as it orbits the Sun, the axis remains pointed in the same direction. It's like a spinning top, and left alone in space, a spinning top does not want to change its orientation. It's got what's called angular momentum. And unless you do something to that top, like try to flip it over, it will remain pointing in the same direction. All right? But 6 months later, then, if the Earth is pointing in the same direction, what will happen? The southern hemisphere of the Earth will be tilted preferentially toward the Sun. And the northern hemisphere of the Earth will be tilted preferentially away from the Sun. Let me illustrate that with this demonstration here. I have the Sun, which is this globe, and the Earth, whose axis is tilted by 23.5 degrees away from the perpendicular, the normal, to the orbital plane. Let's forget about Venus and the Moon for the purposes of this demonstration. Right now, I've oriented things so that it is summer in the northern hemisphere. The North Pole, in fact, is pointing completely at the Sun. All right, it's in the Sun's light all times of the day, and so you have the phenomenon of the midnight Sun. And the southern hemisphere does not see the Sun at all. People there would have to look through the Earth, through a tube, a hole in the Earth, in order to see the Sun. The Sun is below their horizon. In fact, at the South Pole, the Sun is below the horizon for about 6 months of the year, and above the horizon for about 6 months of the year, continuously. Okay. Well, if I now rotate the Earth around the Sun as it orbits the Sun, you can see that the orientation of the Earth's axis has not changed. It is still basically pointing that way up there, as it was when it was on this side of the sun. And now the northern hemisphere is tilted away, and the southern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun. So it would be summer in the southern hemisphere, winter in the northern hemisphere. At points in between, you can see that neither the North Pole nor the South Pole is preferentially tilted toward the sun. And those are the equinoxes, when in fact, in spring and fall, the nights are roughly equally long everywhere on Earth. Well, what then produces the heating effect? Notice in this diagram that in the northern hemisphere summer, say June 22nd, the arc of the sun above the horizon is this big loop, all right? It spends relatively little of its time below the horizon. This is drawn for an intermediate latitude, like most of the United States. At the poles, the sun would look like it's above the horizon all the time. But in the northern hemisphere, it's above the celestial equator, because we're pointed towards it, and so the arc that it goes through during the day is quite long. It spends most of its time there. That means that the Earth's surface gets heated and is illuminated for much of the day, all right? And you get sunlight for much of the day. The most obvious manifestation of the seasons is actually not whether it's cold or warm outside, because, you know, you can have warm days in the winter and you can have awfully cold days in the summer. Mark Twain once said, "The coldest day I ever spent was a summer day in San Francisco," or something to that effect, all right? The most obvious manifestation of the seasons is the changing of the day and night. It is always true that the day is long in the summer in the northern hemisphere. That is, it's above the horizon, whether you can see it or not is immaterial, but it's above the horizon always in the summer for a long time, and it's always below the horizon for a long time in the winter. So the length of the day is clearly related to how long the sun is above the horizon, and you can see that it's above the horizon for a long time in this diagram. Now let's look at the diagram from the perspective of someone watching the sky on the days of the equinoxes, March 21st or 22nd and September 23rd. Then the Earth is oriented in such a way that the sun illuminates the equator from directly overhead. It doesn't illuminate either of the poles most directly. And the sun is right on the celestial equator, and so it's up about half the time, and it's down below the horizon about half the time. All right. And then, in the dead of winter, as seen from the northern hemisphere, the sun is below the celestial equator, and so its arc above the horizon is small, and the arc below the horizon is large. And this leads to a short day in the winter and a long night. Now let's look at the heating effect. All right? When the sunlight directly illuminates the Earth's surface, that is, when the sun is high, that's what I mean by direct, then a given bundle of light, say 1 meter squared in area or 1 meter in length like this, it illuminates 1.04 square meters of the ground. So you've got pretty direct illumination. The light is coming pretty much straight down, and the bundle of light is not being spread out over a very large area. But if the sun is close to the horizon, then that bundle of light is spread out over a larger area. Here's that same bundle of light coming down, 1 square meter worth. The meter that goes in and out of the plane of the television is unaffected, but the meter that is in the plane of the television intersects at an angle relative to the Earth's surface, and that in projection becomes 2.24 meters, and so the total, in fact, at this angle of illumination, 27 degrees or 26 degrees, is 2.34 square meters. So the same bundle of light got spread out over a larger area on Earth's surface, and therefore, per unit area, the surface of the Earth got less sunlight, less heating. And that then leads to the colder temperatures. Okay? It is heated less per unit area, and the day is shorter during the winter months. Now, at the poles, I mentioned that you can see the midnight sun. Here is a view taken by one of the students at University of California at Berkeley of the midnight sun from the South Pole. He was doing research there. And here is sunset at the South Pole. Goodbye, sun. We're not going to see you for about 6 months. Actually, it turns out to be about 5 months because the Earth's atmosphere bends the sunlight up a little bit, this refraction effect. So when you see the sun setting on the horizon, it has actually set in the real world already, but it stays up a little bit longer. Also, the top part of the sun is above the horizon before the bottom part, and that makes the seasons not quite the same length as well. But it's down for about 6 months and up for about 6 months. And the seasons are simply defined that the beginning of summer in the northern hemisphere is June 22nd, when the sun is at its highest point, and the equinoxes are in March and September, and winter is in December. Perhaps paradoxically, summer is defined to be that moment of the year when the sun achieves its highest point in the sky. And then from then on, it's all downhill. You might think that summer should be better defined to be symmetrically located about that point, but that's just not the way it is. Partly, I think, because there's a seasonal lag as to when the atmosphere and the water actually get their hottest temperatures.